"'I'm here. Mrs. Frisbee,' said the shrew. "'You're just in time. I heard a noise and came out and found these creatures trying to dig up your house.'
"'I tried to explain to her,' said Arthur, "'but she won't believe me.'
"'I certainly won't,' said the shrew. "'He said you asked him to dig up your house. Thieving rats!'
"'It's true,' Mrs. Frisbee said. "'I did ask them, and they said they would. It's very kind of them.'
"'Kind?' said the shrew. "'Great hulking beasts! What do you mean?'
It took several more minutes of reassurance by Mrs. Frisbee before the shrew grudgingly moved aside, still muttering warnings.
"'I wouldn't trust them. How do you know they'll do what they say?'
That, of course, Mrs. Frisbee could not explain to her. The rats now commenced to dig busily at the dirt on top of and around Mrs. Frisbee's cinder block. Justin said, "'I've got to go and talk to Nicodemus.' "'You'd better get the children out.' Mrs. Frisbee hurried into her house. She found them waiting in the living room, unaware of the small crisis that had been taking place outside. As Justin had said, they did not seem worried. "'We were scared at first,' Teresa said. "'But then one of the rats came to see us. "'He couldn't come in, but he called to us, and we came out, Martin and I.' He said his name was Justin. Have you met him? He's very nice.
I've met him, said Mrs. Frisbee. Now we'd better go outside. They're getting ready to move the house.
I'm ready, said Timothy. I'm all wrapped up like a scarecrow.
Martin and Teresa had taken pieces of warm cloth from the bed and tied them around him. Mrs. Frisbee could not see him in the dark, but when she touched him, she found they had even tied a piece like a bonnet around his head and ears.
"Good," she said. "And we're lucky. It's a warm night and dry."
They went up the small tunnel to the garden and watched in the moonlight from a hillock a few feet away. The rats had finished digging the new hole, and all 20 of them were working near the house. It was a sight to see. As soon as the earth had been cleared from the top and sides of the cinder block, so that it lay fully exposed in its hole, all of the rats turned to the pile of equipment. Under Arthur's direction, the ladder-like structures became a scaffolding, 4 small towers standing one near each corner of the block. Across the tops of these, the rats fastened strong, light bars of metal, probably, Mrs. Frisbee thought, from the toy tinker's truck. From these bars they now hung pulleys, wound with strong, thin cord, and at the ends of the cords they fastened hooks, which they slipped into the oval-shaped holes in the block and pulled taut. 5 strong rats stood by each cord. One of them, Mrs. Frisbee noticed, was bigger than the rest, her friend Brutus.
"Heave!" called Arthur.
The 20 rats strained on the cords, and the block rose an inch. Each rat stepped back a pace.
"Heave!"
Another inch. Slowly, the heavy block rose from the hole until it hung 2 inches above level ground.
"Steady," said Arthur. "Get the rollers."
8 rats, 2 from each group, ran to the round pieces of wood Mrs. Frisbee had noticed earlier. These resembled sawed-up pieces of broom handle, each about 1 foot long. 2 rats to a roller, they slipped 4 of these under the cinder block so that they lay athwart the hole, like bars across a window.
"Lower away," said Arthur,
and the cinder block came to rest gently on the rollers.
"Let's see how it rolls."
They slipped the ropes free of the pulleys and rehooked 2 of them to the front of the block. 9 rats now manned each rope. 2 stayed behind, watching the rollers.
"Heave!"
The rollers turned, and the heavy block slid forward easily, like a truck on wheels, in the direction of the new hole. When it moved off the hindmost of the rollers, as it did every few inches, The two rats in the rear would quickly pick that one up and replace it under the front of the block. Almost like a game of leapfrog, Mrs. Frisbee thought. But a well-rehearsed game. The rats had planned carefully. They knew exactly what they were doing. They moved with precision and never wasted a motion. Within a very few minutes, the first of the rollers lay across the new hole. Then the second, and finally all four. The block was poised and in position. The hole was exactly the right size and shape. The rats had even dug out a new pantry hole in one corner and carved out the small tunnel that would connect the two rooms of the house. The towers and the pulleys were put up again, and the whole process of lifting and lowering was done in reverse. The rollers were pulled away, and the block was eased slowly into its new home. "It's done!" cried Mrs. Frisbee. She felt like applauding.
"Not quite yet," said Arthur over his shoulder. To the other rats, he said, "Get the shovels and the backpacks."
Pausing a moment to rest, he explained to Mrs. Frisbee.
"We're going to cover it with turf, and then we've got to fill up the old hole with the dirt from the new one, or Mr. Fitzgibbon will wonder who's been digging up his garden. Also, we've still to dig you an entrance hole."
In her excitement, Mrs. Frisbee had forgotten this small detail. She could not get into her house. Now she watched in awe as Arthur and Brutus, using two small, sharp, long-handled shovels, dug the narrow tunnel down to her living room. It took them somewhat less than 5 minutes. It had taken her all day to dig the other one.
"Now," said Arthur, "you can put your children to bed. We'll take care of the rest."
At the meeting, Mrs. Frisbee slept well and soundly. The day just finished having been the longest and hardest she had ever known. She awoke in the morning with a smile. Her house was warm, and it was safe at last. Her children slept peacefully beside her. Timothy's breathing was quiet and easy. They could stay in the house now as long as they needed to. On some warm day later in the spring, when Timothy was strong again, they would move to the summer house down by the brook. Another nice thing, she thought. When they left the house, she would close up the entrance tunnel so that no one could find it. Undisturbed by the plough, it would be ready and waiting for them in the fall. It could be theirs forever, thanks to the rats. The rats! In her half-dreaming state, she had forgotten. They were in terrible danger. What would they do? She felt as if she ought to go and offer to help them. But help how? She could think of nothing she could do. At that moment, she heard a voice calling her name from above. "Mrs. Frisbee?" She left the bed and went to the bottom of the entrance hole. "Yes? Who's calling?"
"It's me, Brutus. Can you come up?"
Mrs. Frisbee climbed up and out her front door, blinking in the early morning sunlight.
"Nicodemus wants to know if you can come with me. He's having a meeting."
"Just let me wake the children and tell them." 2 minutes later, she was walking with Brutus toward the rose bush. "What does Nicodemus want?"
"It's about the men. Justin told us last night. Nicodemus thinks they may be from Nim. He wants to ask you more about what Mr. Fitzgibbon said."
That morning there were two rats on sentry duty, one just inside the entrance to the rose bush, watching Mr. Fitzgibbon's house, another at the arch where Brutus had stood. All of the rest were gathered in the large assembly room Mrs. Frisbee had seen when she got off the elevator. Nicodemus, Justin, Arthur, and two other rats sat on the raised platform at the end. The rest sat facing them, filling every square inch of floor space except for an aisle up the center. Mrs. Frisbee had never seen so many rats. Even the young ones were present. She spotted Isabella, staring up at the platform with wide, round eyes. Some of the mothers held small babies at their sides. Most of them looked anxious. There was an air of tension, but none of panic. Brutus led her up the center aisle to the raised platform. There was a table on it, covered with papers, and one vacant space where a chair had been placed for Mrs. Frisby. The rats waited in complete silence while she sat down. Then Nicodemus said, quite formally, "Justin has told us all that happened. Mrs. Frisby, it seems you have more than repaid us for the help we gave you in moving your house. Just as your husband did once, you have saved us from a disaster. Death or capture, we do not yet know which." Justin gave her a wink.
"Mrs. Frisby had a taste of capture herself last night.
Would you tell us, as well as you can remember it, word for word, what Mr. Fitzgibbon said? About the rats, about the men who were at the store?"
"As well as I can remember it," Mrs. Frisby's voice sounded small in the big room, "Mr. Fitzgibbon said a strange thing had happened in the hardware store. Henderson's, he called it." Her memory was good. She had listened with great care to what Mr. Fitzgibbon had said, and she was able to recall the whole conversation word for word. The rats sat quietly while she told it. Then Nicodemus went back over it, asking questions.
"You say that Mr. Fitzgibbon said 6 or 7 rats. Did he ever say which number it really was?"
"No, I don't think he paid much attention to the number."
"Jenner's group was 7, said Justin, "but it could be a coincidence."
"Did he say how far away the town was where this happened, or did he name it?"
"No, but it must not be very far. He'd been there and back that day."
"Did anyone see his car go out?"
Nicodemus asked the others.
"I heard it," Brutus said. "I was on duty. It went after lunch. And he was back by dinner."
"But which direction?" "If we knew, we might send someone. You see," Nicodemus explained to Mrs. Frisby, "we need to know who those men are. If they're from Nim, things are much worse for us."
"We'd never make it," said Arthur. "Driving at, say, 40 or 50 miles an hour, Mr. Fitzgibbon might have gone 15 or 20 miles in any direction, and returned easily the same afternoon."
"On the map," there was a road map on the table,
"you can see it could have been any one of 6 small towns, and each of them might have a hardware store." "You're right, of course," said Nicodemus. "Without the name, that idea's hopeless."
He turned back to Mrs. Frisby.
"Mr. Fitzgibbon said the rats were grouped around the motor as if they were trying to move it."
"That's what he said the store owner told him.
He didn't see it himself."
"And that the motor was plugged in?"
"Had been left plugged in," Mrs. Frisby quoted. "But we don't know who plugged it in."
"I got the impression," Mrs. Frisby said, "from the way he said it, that the store owner had left it plugged in. But I'm not sure."
"That would make sense," Arthur said. "If it was Jenner, and if they had plugged it in themselves, they'd have known better than to try to move it. So they might not have realized. It was probably pretty dark in the store."
"Poor Jenner," said Nicodemus.
"I wish he had stayed with us."
"It would be poor us," said one of the rats at the table. Mrs. Frisby did not know his name. "If we don't get on with this..."
"He did not mention the doctor's name," Nicodemus said.
"Did he say even a word about what he looked like?"
"No."
"Did he describe the truck at all?"
"No, only that it was full of equipment."
"Are you sure about the headline in the local paper, 'Mechanized Rats Invade Hardware Store'?"
"I'm sure that's what Mr. Fitzgibbon said it was. But I don't think he saw it. He didn't say so."
"In a way, that's the most puzzling thing about the whole story," Nicodemus said.
"Why is that?"
asked Justin. "Because the headline doesn't really fit the facts. You don't call a bunch of dead rats mechanized just because you find them on a shelf near a motor."
"Maybe not," said the nameless rat. "But then why did the newspaper say that?"
"I'm wondering," Nicodemus said, "if perhaps there wasn't more to the story. Some stronger reason to think they were really taking the motor away, or that they knew how to use it."
"Maybe some other motors had been stolen," Justin said, "or some tools. That would make them seem mechanized."
"It would," said Nicodemus, "and it would explain what the doctor meant when he said they had more checking to do in town."
"They're looking for the things that were missing," Arthur said, sounding suddenly worried. "They're looking for Jenner's headquarters. And if they find it..."
"We're just guessing, of course," Nicodemus said. "But it's a possibility.
And a bad one."
"It means," Nicodemus continued, "that we have no choice. We've got to assume they're from Nim. We've also got to assume that by now they may have found Jenner's headquarters, whatever cave or cavern they were using.
And," said Justin, "that now they're looking for us."
"Why for us?" asked one of the rats. "Why wouldn't they think Jenner's group are the only ones?"
"They might," Nicodemus admitted. "But I don't think so. After all, they know that there were 20 of us originally. Why should there be only 7 now? And we already know that they're coming out here, in quite a hurry at that. So if they're from Nim, obviously they are looking for us."
"I think," said Arthur, "that we've got to make some plans, and quickly."
"I agree," said Nicodemus.
"It's a new situation, and a tricky one. We won't be able to do everything we hope to. There isn't time. And somehow we have to convince the exterminators, when they come, that we aren't more of the mechanized rats they're looking for. We won't be able to move any more food to Thorn Valley," Nicodemus continued. "We'll have to get along on what we've already got stored there. About an 18-month supply, if we're careful. The seeds, I believe, are already moved."
"Yes," said Arthur. "The last load went yesterday."
"So, with luck, we'll have our own first crops this summer and fall." "We won't have time to destroy the motors, or the books, or the furniture, as we planned. Instead, we'll move everything to the cave, and then we'll seal off all entrances to the cave as if it had never existed."
"That can be done," Arthur said.
"But there's more. We've got to pull all the wires and lights from the tunnel. They're likely to dig it up. And the carpet. We've got to tear down the arch. Then, when all that's done, when everything is hidden in the cave, we'll fill in the stairway and the elevator shaft. We'll seal off everything except the upper storage room and the tunnels leading in the front and out the back. When they dig, let them find that room. It's as big as an ordinary rat hole. Justin, tonight take a group of 12 or so. Go to the Fitzgibbons garbage can. Bring back a load of the worst-smelling garbage you can find. The storage room is going to become an ordinary, typical rat hole, not in the least mechanized or civilized."
Nicodemus turned to Arthur.
"What do you think?" "I think we can do it all. We won't get much sleep, though."
Justin said, "But there's one more thing. Won't they think it's odd, especially if they're from Nim, finding just an empty hole?"
Nicodemus said, "I was coming to that." He sounded suddenly very tired.
"Tomorrow morning, as soon as it's light, the main group leaves for Thorn Valley. But some of us will have to stay behind. As Justin says, if they find just an empty hole, they're sure to be suspicious, and they'll keep on digging. So, when they come with their gas truck, they've got to find some rats here. A rear guard. I'd say at least 10.
Mrs. Frisbee walked slowly home, keeping to the edge of the woods, keeping out of sight. Justin had instantly volunteered for the rear guard. Brutus was second, and behind him, 8 more. There were 50 more waiting behind them.
"Enough, enough," said Nicodemus.
Isabella, in tears, had run forward. "I want to stay, please," she had pleaded, looking despairingly at Justin.
"No children," said Nicodemus.
And her mother led her away, still weeping. Those 10, the 10 who would remain, did not face certain death, nor certain capture. The exterminators, they presumed, would make noise, especially if they cleared away the rosebush. The rats would be alerted. When the men pumped gas, as expected, into the hole, the pump would also make a noise. The air below would move as the gas flowed in. When they felt that, the rats would scramble out the back exit, past the sealed-off cave, emerge as noisily as possible in the blackberry bramble, indeed show themselves, and dash off into the woods. "But won't they block the rear exit? Or put a net over it?"
"We'll give them another rear exit to block," Arthur had said cryptically. "One that's easier to find."
"Mother, why are you so quiet?" asked Teresa. They were sitting down to dinner for the first time in their newly moved house. "You seem sad."
"I suppose I am," Mrs. Frisbee said.
"Because the rats are all going away."
"But that's no reason."
"It's true. They moved our house, and that was nice of them.
But we didn't really know them."
"I was getting to know them pretty well."
"Where are they going?"
Cynthia asked. "To a new home. A long way away."
"When?"
"Tomorrow morning."
"Will you go to see them off?"
"I think I will."
"But why are they moving away?" asked Timothy.
"Because they want to," said Mrs. Frisbee. Some day soon she would tell them the whole story. But not that night.
The Doctor. The next morning, Mr. Fitzgibbon started the larger of his two tractors. The huge one he kept in the barn, the one that pulled the combine in the fall harvest. With help from Paul and Billy, he bolted the big bulldozer blade to the front of it, rumbled it up through the barnyard gate, and stopped it near the rosebush. "We'll wait until they come," he said, turning off the engine. Mrs. Frisbee could not bear to watch, and yet even more she could not bear not to watch. She knew there was nothing to be gained by it, nothing she could do. Yet how could she stay at home when the 10 rats, including Justin and Brutus, were waiting bravely underground? She could not. She thought at first of her watch-hole in the corner post. Then she decided against it. Nearer to the rosebush, on the edge of the woods, stood a hickory tree, its scaly bark like a ladder inviting her to climb. 10 feet up on this tree, a large branch jutted straight out. On this branch, up close to the trunk, she had a vantage point from which, herself unseen, she could look down on the rosebush and also see into the woods to a blackberry bramble, where, though she had never been in it, she was sure the rat's rear exit must be hidden. She settled down to wait. It was a chilly morning, with a damp breeze and a grey mist that blew by in patches. Somewhere near the middle of the morning, a square white truck came into the driveway. It went first to the house. A man in a white coverall uniform climbed out and knocked on the Fitzgibbons' door. It was too far away for Mrs. Frisbee to hear the knock, or to hear what the man said when Mrs. Fitzgibbon came out on the porch. But 10 seconds later, Billy ran from the house to the barn, where Mr. Fitzgibbon was working. The man returned to the truck and waited, standing outside the open cab door. Through the windshield she could see that 2 more men sat in the front seat, and that one of them wore horn-rimmed glasses. Now Mr. Fitzgibbon approached the truck, Billy dancing beside him, apparently in some excitement. There was a conference, none of which Mrs. Frisbee could hear, accompanied by gestures toward the rosebush and the waiting bulldozer. The man in white climbed back into the driver's seat and drove the truck across the grass. He backed it up beside the bulldozer, stopping perhaps 10 feet from the bush. Mrs. Frisbee stared at it. If there was anything printed on it, it must be on the other side, away from her. Then three men climbed out, and she could hear what they said.
"It's a big one, all right," said one of the men. "And look at those thorns. It's hard to see how even a rat could get in there."
The man in the horn rims walked around the edge of the bush, examining it closely. He bent over.
"Look at this," he said.
"There's the entrance hole, very neatly hidden. And look behind it. A path leading in." He turned to Mr. Fitzgibbon, who had walked up with Billy.
"You were right, you'll need to bulldoze it. It would take us all day to hack our way in there. But cut it off just at the surface if you can. If you dig too deep and open the hole, they'll get away." He added, "You better tell the boy to keep back. We'll be using cyanide, and it's dangerous."
Billy, after some argument, was dispatched to the back porch, where Mrs. Fitzgibbon was also watching. One of the men had walked around to the far side of the bush, the side near Mrs. Frisbee's tree.
"Doc," he called, "here's another entrance in the bush, and there's a hole just inside it."
Doc was the man in horn rims. He was a doctor. Mrs. Frisbee thought, "Doctor somebody." He was in charge.
"Can you get at it?" he asked. "Not very well. Too many thorns."
The man who was a doctor walked around and looked at it.
"No," he said. "Anyway, that would be the escape hatch. We'll find the main hole nearer the middle of the bush."
He turned to Mr. Fitzgibbon, who had mounted the tractor.
"Okay," said the doctor. "Can you push it that way, away from the shed?"
Mr. Fitzgibbon nodded, and the motor started with a roar. He pulled a lever and flexed the heavy steel blade up and down, bringing the bottom edge to rest just even with the ground. The blade was fully 8 feet across. He pulled another lever. The wheels, with cleated tires as tall as windows, dug in, and the blade scraped forward. The bush fought back, then yielded angrily, snapping and crackling before the inexorable thrust of steel. A single sweep, and a third of it lay a writhing heap of thorns, in a pile 20 feet away. The ground trembled under the wheels, and Mrs. Frisbee thought of the 10 rats huddled below. Supposing the weight collapsed the earth, caved in the storage room, and trapped them? Another sweep, and a third. Only a thorny stubble now stood where the bush had been. On the porch, Mrs. Fitzgibbon covered her eyes with her hands, and Billy cheered in excitement. Plainly exposed were two holes, simple, round rat holes. There was no trace of the small mound, nor the elegant arched entrance. Arthur had done his work thoroughly. Mrs. Frisbee wondered for a moment at the second hole. Then she remembered his saying, "We'll give them another rear exit to block." Of course! They had dug another hole, most likely, she thought. Just a dummy, leading nowhere. The men in the white suits went into action. The back doors of the truck were opened, and a long, flexible pipe unrolled. It looked like a fire hose, except that at the end, instead of a nozzle, there was a round plunger, like a big rubber ball cut in half. One of the men donned a mask with a glass visor and a tube that ran to the pack on his back, a gas mask. The masked man pulled the hose over to the center rat hole and pressed the plunger over it, covering it completely. From the back of the truck, the other two took a large box made of wood and wire, almost a yard wide, and placed it over the second hole. It was a cage, but half of its bottom was a trap door, neatly mounted on hinges. This they raised, placing the open part directly over the opening in the earth. Then they backed away, one of them holding a trip cord, which would close the trap door after the rats were inside.
"All set?"
the doctor called to the man in the mask. The mask nodded. "Keep back now," said the doctor to Mr. Fitzgibbon, who had left his tractor to watch. He walked to the truck, reached inside, and turned a switch. Mrs. Frisby heard the soft throb of a pump. "Now." She turned and watched the blackberry bramble in the woods. Would they hear the pump? Where were they? Oh, let them come out. Almost a minute passed. The men in white watched the trap. Nothing moved. Then she saw it. Behind the bramble, half hidden by a swirl of mist, a gray-brown shape, a rat, shaking dirt from his ears. Another, then three more. They huddled in silence, waiting. More? How many? 10? 7. Only 7. Where were the other 3? Still, they waited. Then, as if by agreement, they stopped waiting. They ran, all 7 of them, not back into the woods to safety, but out of the woods toward the stubble of the rose bush, toward the men. At the edge of the bush, they stopped as if in confusion, ran to the left, ran to the right, then fled back into the woods again. Now they were out of sight of the men, but not of Mrs. Frisby. Instantly they regrouped behind the blackberry bramble and charged out again, but this time in smaller numbers, first 2, then 3, then 2 again. She saw what they were up to. They were not in the least confused. They were making 7 rats look like 20 rats, or 40, a steady stream of them. In the mist, in the hectic turning, running, turning, hiding, she could not tell whether or not she recognized any of them. The men shouted, "Look at that! A pack of them! How do they get out? Get the nets!" The doctor turned off the pump. The man with the hose pulled off his mask. As a new wave of rats danced along the edge of the clearing, all 3 men ran to the truck and from it pulled long-handled nets. But Mrs. Frisby, up on her branch, was staring at the blackberry bush again. She saw something that all of the others, including the rats, did not see. An 8th rat had come out. He emerged running, but then he stumbled. He got up and ran again, this time more slowly, circling vaguely to the right. He did not seem to know where he was going. He reached a sparse thicket of saplings, almost out of her sight, and there, abruptly, he fell over on his side and lay still. Meanwhile, all 3 men, holding their nets low, ran across the stubble toward the parade of rats. But as they approached the parade, it vanished. The rats, their purpose accomplished, melted into the misty woods, and this time they did not reappear. Mrs. Frisby watched them as they loped away swiftly in single file and disappeared from her view, back into the deep forest and up the mountainside. The rear guard was gone, bound for Thorn Valley. But the 8th rat still lay unmoving among the saplings, and 2 had never come out at all. "They're gone," said the man who had worn the mask. "They fooled us." "What happened?" asked Mr. Fitzgibbon, standing near the truck. "Simple enough," said the doctor. "They had 2 escape holes, and they used the other one." He walked back to the blackberry bramble and bent down, kicking the branches aside with his foot. "Here it is," he said. "Quite a long tunnel. One of the longest I've seen." To the other 2 men he said, "Get the pick and the shovels." For 30 minutes they dug, laying open a narrow trench along the tunnel. From her angle of view in the tree, Mrs. Frisby could see only the top of this trench and not down into the bottom. Still she watched, saying to herself, perhaps after all, there were only 8. Maybe they decided that 8 would be enough. Then one of the shovels broke through into air. They had come to the rat's storage room. "There's 2 of them," said one of the men, and her heart sank. Who were they? She wanted to run and look, but she did not dare. "Careful," said the doctor. "There may still be some gas in there. Let the wind blow it out." "Phew," said one of the men.
That's not gas, that's garbage.
Open it up a little more, said the doctor. One of the men wielded his shovel for another minute, and then the doctor peered in.
Garbage, he said. Last night's dinner. Garbage and 2 dead rats.
Mrs. Frisby thought, he sounds disappointed.
Only 2? Said Mr. Fitzgibbon.
Yes, it's easy to see what happened. In a hole this size, there would have been a couple of dozen at least. But these 2 must have been up at the front, near the tunnel. They got a whiff of the gas, and it killed them. But before they died, they must have warned the others, so the rest ran out.
Warned them? Said Mr. Fitzgibbon. Could they do that?
Yes, said the doctor. They're intelligent animals. Some can do a great deal more than that.
But he did not elaborate. Instead, he turned to one of the men.
We might as well take these 2 back with us.
From the truck, the man produced a white paper sack and a pair of plastic gloves. He pulled the gloves on, reached into the hole, and placed the 2 dead rats into the sack. He did this with his back to Mrs. Frisby, so that she never got even a glimpse of them.
All right, said the doctor. Let's close it up.
They shoveled the dirt back into the trench and returned to the truck.
You'll let me know if they have rabies? Said Mr. Fitzgibbon.
Rabies? Said the doctor.
Yes, of course. But I doubt it. They look perfectly healthy.
Perfectly healthy, thought Mrs. Frisby sadly. Except for being dead. She looked into the woods, over toward the saplings where the other rat lay. Was he, too, now dead? To her surprise, she saw that he was moving. Or was he? In the mist it was hard to tell, but something had moved. After the truck had left, Mr. Fitzgibbon stood looking at the ruin of the rosebush. He seemed vaguely puzzled and disappointed. He must be wondering, she thought, whether it had been worth it, just to exterminate 2 rats. He had no way of knowing, of course, that all the rest were also gone and would not return, that his grain loft was safe. In a moment he turned and walked to the house. As soon as he was safely gone, Mrs. Frisby scurried down from her tree and into the woods. On the ground she could no longer see the rat or the thicket where he lay, but she knew the direction, and she ran. Around a stump over a mound of leaves, past a cedar tree, there were the saplings, and there lay the rat, still on his side. It was Brutus. Beside him, futilely trying to move him, stood Mr. Ages. She reached him, breathless from her run. Is he dead?
No, he's unconscious, but he's alive and breathing. I think he'll revive if I can just get him to swallow this.
Mr. Ages indicated a small corked bottle, no bigger than a thimble, on the ground beside them.
What is it?
An antidote for the poison. We thought this might happen, so we got it ready last night. He got just a little of the gas, made it this far, and then collapsed.
Help me lift his head.
Mr. Ages had been unable to lift Brutus's head and the bottle at the same time. Now, with Mrs. Frisby's help, he forced open Brutus's mouth and poured in just a few drops of the smoky liquid the bottle contained. In a few seconds, Brutus made a gulping noise, swallowed hard, and spoke.
"It's dark," he said. "I can't see." "Open your eyes," said Mr. Ages.
Brutus opened them and looked around.
"I'm out," he said. "How did I get here?"
"Don't you remember?"
"No, wait, yes. I was in the hole. I smelled gas, an awful, choking, sweet smell. I tried to run, but I stumbled over somebody lying on the floor, and I fell down. I must have breathed some of the gas. I couldn't get up.
And then?"
"I heard the others running past me. I couldn't see them. It was darker than night. Then one of them ran into me and stopped. He pulled me up, and I tried to run again, but I was too dizzy. I kept falling. The other one helped me up again, and I went a few steps more,
He kept pulling me and then pushing, and somehow, finally, I got to the end of the tunnel. I saw daylight, and the air smelled better, but there was nobody else there. I thought the others must have left, so I ran a little farther, and that's all I remember. Mrs. Frisbee said, "What about the one who helped you?"
"I don't know who it was. I couldn't see, and he didn't speak at all. I suppose he was trying to hold his breath. When we got near the end and I could see daylight, he gave me one last shove toward it, and then he turned back."
"He went back?"
"Yes. You see, there was still one rat back in there, the one I stumbled over. I think he went back to help that one."
"Whoever he was," said Mrs. Frisbee, "he never came out. He died in there."
"Whoever he was," said Mr. Ages, "he was brave."
Epilogue. A few days later, early in the morning, the plough came through the garden. Mrs. Frisbee heard the chug of the tractor and the soft scrape of the steel against the earth. She watched from just inside her front door, fearfully at first, but then with growing confidence. The owl and the rats had calculated wisely, and the nearest furrow was more than 2 feet from her house. Behind the plough, in the moist and shining soil, the rudely upturned red-brown earthworms writhed in a frenzy to rebury themselves. Hopping along each furrow, a flock of spring robins tried to catch them before they slid from sight. And when the ploughing was done, and the worms had all disappeared, either eaten or safely underground, Mr. Fitzgibbon came back with the harrow, breaking down the furrows and turning them all up again. It was a good day for the robins. After the harrow, for the next 2 days, came the Fitzgibbons themselves, all four of them, with hoes and bags of seeds, planting lettuce, beans, spinach, potatoes, corn, and mustard greens. Mrs. Frisbee and her family kept out of sight. Thoughtfully, Brutus and Arthur had dug their doorway behind a tuft of grass, so that not even Billy noticed it. Brutus and Arthur. Mrs. Frisbee did not suppose she would ever see either of them again, nor Nicodemus, nor any of the others. Brutus, after swallowing Mr. Age's medicine and resting for half an hour, had gone on his way into the forest to join the colony in Thorn Valley. There was no talk of their coming back, unless their attempt to grow their own food should fail, and she did not believe that would happen. They were too smart. And even if they did fail, they would probably not come back to Mr. Fitzgibbon's farm. She thought it would be pleasant to visit them and see their new home, their small lake and their crops growing. But she had no idea where the valley was, and it would be, in any case, too long a journey for her and the children. So she could only wonder about them. Were they at that moment like the Fitzgibbons, planting seeds behind their own plough? Some, like Isabella's mother, might grumble about the hardness of the new life they'd chosen. Yet the story of what had happened to Jenner and his friends, if it was Jenner and his friends, to say nothing of the destruction of their own home, would surely help to convince them that Nicodemus's ideas were right. The Fitzgibbons finished their planting, and for a week or two all was quiet. But it would not stay that way. The crops would appear, the asparagus was ready to sprout, and for the rest of the spring and summer the garden would be too busy a place for mice to live in comfortably. So on a day in May, as warm as summer, early in the morning, Mrs. Frisbee and her children laid a patchwork of sticks, grass, and leaves over the top of the entrance to their cinder-block house, and then carefully scraped earth over it so that it would not show. With luck, they would not have to dig a new one in the fall. They walked to their summer house, taking half a day to do it, strolling slowly and enjoying the fine weather, stopping on the way to eat some new spring leaves of field cress, some young poke greens, and a crisp, spicy mushroom that had sprouted by the edge of the woods. For their main course, a little farther on, there was a whole field of winter wheat, its kernels newly ripe and soft. As they approached the brook, toward the big tree in the hollow of whose roots they would make their summer home, the children ran ahead, shouting and laughing. Timothy ran with them, and Mrs. Frisby was glad to see that he showed no trace of his sickness. It was an exciting time for them. In the garden they were always alone with themselves, but along the bank of the brook in summer lived five other mice families, all with children. Within a few minutes of arrival, her four had gone with a group of the others down to the water to see the tadpoles swim. Mrs. Frisby set about the job of tidying up the house, which had acquired a carpet of dead leaves during the winter, and then bringing in a pile of soft green moss to serve as bedding for them all. The house was a roomy chamber with a pleasant earthy smell. Its floor was hard-packed dirt, and its wooden roof was an arched intertwining of roots, above which rose the tree itself, an oak. On her way to get the moss, she saw one of her neighbors, a lady mouse named Janice, who, like herself, had four children. Janice ran over to talk to her.
"You're so late getting here," she said. "We all thought something must have happened to you."
"No," said Mrs. Frisby. "We're all fine."
"But don't you live in the garden?" Janice persisted. "I should have thought you'd be afraid of the plowing."
"As a matter of fact," Mrs. Frisby explained, "they didn't plow the particular spot in the garden where we live. It's behind a boulder."
"You were lucky."
"That's true." More than that, Mrs. Frisby did not tell. She had agreed to keep a secret, and she would do as she had said. Still, she thought, after quite a long deliberation, it was probably all right to tell her children, first making them promise to keep it a secret. They were, after all, the children of Jonathan Frisby. For all she knew, and for all Nicodemus knew, they were likely to turn out to be quite different from other mice, and they had a right to know the reason. The following evening, therefore, when they had finished an early supper, she gathered them around her. "Children, I have a story to tell you. A long one."
"Oh, good!" cried Cynthia. "What kind of a story?"
"A true one. About your father and about the rats."
"How can it be about father and the rats?"
Teresa asked. "Because he was a friend of theirs."
"He was?" said Martin incredulously. "I never knew that."
"It was mostly before you were born." To everyone's surprise, Timothy said, "I thought he might be. I think Mr. Ages was, too."
"How did you know that?"
"I didn't know it. I just thought it. A couple of times I saw Mr. Ages leaving their rosebush, and I knew that Father used to visit him a lot. But I never saw him near the rosebush."
"Probably," Mrs. Frisby thought, "because he would have been careful always to leave through the blackberry bramble, just so we would not see him." They sat down outside the entrance to the house, and beginning at the beginning, with her first visit to the rats, she told them all that she had seen and done, and all that Nicodemus had told her. It took a long time to tell, and as she talked, the sun sank low, turning the sky red and lighting the tops of the mountains, beyond which, somewhere, the rats of Nim were living. The children's eyes grew round when she told them about the escape from Nim, and even rounder when she described her own capture and escape from the birdcage. But in the end, the eyes of Teresa and Cynthia were filled with tears, and Martin and Timothy looked sad. Teresa said,
"But, Mother, that's terrible. It must have been Justin. He saved Brutus and then went back. And he was so nice."
Mrs. Frisby said, "It may have been Justin. We can't be sure. It could have been one of the others." Martin said,
"I'm going to find out.
I'm going to go to the Thorn Valley somehow, someday. But it's too far, and you don't know where it is.
No, but I'll bet Jeremy knows. Remember he told you the rats had a clearing back in the hills? That must be in Thorn Valley.
He thought about this for a minute. Then he added, he might even fly me there on his back, the way he did you.
But we don't know where Jeremy is, either. We don't see the crows down here, Mrs. Frisbee reminded him.
No, but in the fall, when we go back to the garden, I could find him then. If I got something shiny and put it out in the sun, he'd come to get it.
Martin was growing excited at his idea. Oh, Mother, may I?
I don't know. I doubt that the rats will want visitors from the outside.
They wouldn't mind. After all, you helped them, and so did Father. And I wouldn't do any harm.
It's not something we have to decide tonight, said Mrs. Frisbee. I'll think about it. And now it's late. It's time for bed. The sun had set. They went into the house and lay down on the soft moss Mrs. Frisbee had placed on the floor of their room under the roots. Outside, the brook swam quietly through the woods, and up above them, the warm wind blew through the newly opened leaves of the big oak tree. They went to sleep.
The End. You've been listening to Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim by Robert C. O'Brien, narrated by Barbara Caruso. This work, copyrighted 1971 by Robert C. O'Brien, is recorded by arrangement with the successors to the interests of Robert C. O'Brien and the Barney Karpfinger Agency. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books, Incorporated. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery, also narrated by Barbara Caruso. Written in 1906, Anne of Green Gables is the classic story of a young orphan girl adopted into a farm family on Prince Edward Island. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone, with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.